going to be case number 67736, No Perez versus the State of Nevada. And we'll get set. Mr. Carlin and Mr. Sweden. Mr. Carlin, do you want to reserve some time on this? Three?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Carlin. I represent the appellant, Noe Perez. Chief Justice Terry and Justices, this case is a case of credibility. The alleged victim and the main witness in this case changed their testimony at trial. There was no physical evidence of a crime presented at trial, and the defendant, Mr. Perez, admitted to law enforcement during an interrogation that he kissed the alleged victim. And the state had a very weak case, and there were plenty of opportunities for defense counsel to attack those. What I'd like to do is argue four points. First of all, I'd like to argue that district court failed to correctly apply the law of the case doctrine. After that, I'd like to move on to the district court inappropriately determined that the defendant had not established a reasonable probability of success of the issues appellate counsel failed to raise on appeal, which will naturally bring me to the myriad of other errors that were cumulative in trial counsel's performance. And finally, if there's time, I'd like to discuss how the district court failed to articulate any findings and conclusions of law when it denied the defendant's petition. But before I cut into my argument, I'd like to know, are there any questions that you'd like to cut the chase to any of these particular issues? Seeing none, I'm going to talk about how the district court failed to correctly apply the law of case doctrine in this matter. The law of the case doctrine states that only applies to issues previously determined, not to matters left open by the appellate court. This doctrine frequently comes up in previous proceedings. The state regularly attempts to dismiss ineffective assistance of counsel issues under the guise of the law of the doctrine case, as was the case in this matter. In this case, the district court determined that Mr. Perez had re-raised issues that had been rejected on appeal that could not be raised as ineffective assistance of counsel claims. But the issues that I raised in the habeas corpus proceedings were different. First, I argued that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to attack an appeal or attack on appeal the sufficiency of the notice of expert and the extent of the expert testimony on the basis of bad timing. Second, I argued that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to attack on appeal that the expert testimony failed to assist the jury in understanding the evidence or determining an issue in the case. And finally, I argued that trial counsel's deficient performance definitely prejudiced the defendant. I specifically argued in briefing that the state concealed the intended purpose of calling the expert, being the faith element, and that trial counsel failed to count that on appeal. Now, as we know under the Strickland standard, there's a two-pronged test. We have a deficiency, what a reasonable attorney would do, and then we have the prejudice standard. Would the outcome have been different if counsel didn't do that? The second prong is the most difficult prong to overcome in that Strickland analysis. This court never addressed the prejudice to the defendant in the context of the expert testimony on the ineffective assistance of counsel standard during the direct appeal. I simply asked the district court to address the faults this court found with appellate counsel in rendering those arguments on appeal.
Were you seeking an evidentiary hearing on your PC petition?
I was, Your Honor. Yes, I always request an evidentiary hearing.
Thank you. And that hearing would have proved what?
Well, I would have...
Had you been allowed to proceed?
What I intended to do is bring in trial counsel, and there were actually three of them in this matter, and to ask them specifically questions regarding the issues of ineffectiveness for failing to raise certain things on appeal and preparation for trial, as I'll address later in the arguments. There were specific things that I enumerated in the petition that the record couldn't substantiate, and that there was a conflict in the facts. And that's why I asked for an evidentiary hearing.
What about prejudice?
What was the purpose of the evidentiary hearing on the issue of prejudice? What was your offer of proof? What's your contention here on appeal?
The offer of proof that after an evidentiary hearing is based on the facts that I would have liked to elicit from trial counsel. I would have said, not only there may be some cumulative effect, but because these weren't challenged under the standard that this court identified, he was prejudiced, and the outcome would have been different on appeal. I understand that's the most difficult prong of that test, but we can't even get to that prong unless I get out the deficiency arguments, what reasonable counsel should have done. That would have been the basis for the evidentiary hearing to get to that second prong.
I'm assuming for the moment that the district court found that there was deficiency. What's your argument on the prejudice prong?
What's
the basis for contending that there would have been a different outcome in this case?
My argument with basically the trial counsel portion, the trial portion, is that that the defendant was prejudiced because his trial team, I say team because there were three, really weren't prepared. They really didn't understand what the evidence was going to be. How can you formulate a defense if you don't know that? Multiple times in the record, trial counsel said, I'm surprised at that testimony, or I didn't look at that evidence, I didn't have the proper equipment. There were multiple instances that he put on there that he was not prepared. And as we all know, when you have a multitude of these types of issues, how can you argue that the defendant actually was granted Sixth Amendment right to counsel?
Maybe we're not communicating. I'll try to ask my question one more time.
I'm sorry.
Conceding your point, the trial counsel wasn't prepared or that they hadn't done something correctly, could you please explain to me how that deficiency would have resulted in a different outcome in this case, as required by the second prong instruction? Give me a piece of evidence or an error that occurred that would have made a difference. I understand you characterize this as cumulative, so give me two or three.
Well, Your Honor, courts indulge just a moment. I think one of the things that probably the most blatant was his continuing the prejudicial effect of failing to stipulate to a foundation the jailhouse recordings. That's just something that defense counsel generally does 99% of the time, because we do not want to let the trier fact know that our guy's in custody. We dress him out, we don't bring in prior bad acts, we don't do any of that type of stuff. So he consistently, and even the court was confused, she didn't understand why he wouldn't. That was certainly prejudicial. Another instance of prejudice is he asked for a mistrial in the presence of the jury, which you don't do, you always wait till they go out. Another issue that I think was definitely prejudicial, I'll just leave it at that. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
I understand your position.
Okay. But as I said, going back to the law of the case doctrine, the doctrine only applies to issues that were previously determined and not left open. Now, I think, Justice Harris, you going into some of the question you had on prejudicial, that would be the problem of the second argument here. In this case, the district court ruled that this court's opinion regarding bad faith or prejudice combined with a dissenting opinion does not equate to be a reliable proof of reasonable probability of success on appeal. And I agree that a dissenting opinion is not going to be sufficient to constitute what the Tenth Circuit calls a dead bang winner. But when combined with the facts and analysis of the supplemental petition, I argue that there is a dead bang winner, because I argue that he was ineffective for the same reasons that we just discussed, namely that he didn't argue on appeal the notice of expert witnesses sufficiency using the bad faith standard. He didn't argue that the expert's testimony didn't help the jury at all with the evidence, and that that because he was unsuccessful at getting this the expert's prejudicial testimony out, it prejudiced the defendant because the jury heard it. And that was discussed in this court's opinion and the dissenting opinion as well. So I combined with the facts of this case, these issues create what the Tenth Circuit does call a dead bang winner that should have resulted in a reversal on the appeal. I'd like to briefly discuss some of the errors that I've argued were cumulative that should have caused the reversal of the dismissal order, and I've touched on some of these with your question here. First of all, trial counsel's failure to investigate and prepare for the trial. The record's replete, and I've enumerated a list of those. He was constantly objecting to the jailhouse phone calls. He was continuously requesting mistrials, as I said, once in front of a jury. He was unprepared for sentencing. He said he had left his file at home. He also said he left something else at his office, another portion.
Mr. Carling.
Yes.
Is it Carling?
Yes.
Mr. Carling, just on that last point. So if he had his file, what would have been different? If he had not asked for a mistrial, what would have been different? I mean, did you get any information from any jurors, anything to support what would have actually been different?
I appreciate that question. No, I didn't get any information from juries. I'm just listing what I noticed was a reasonable attorney wouldn't have done. It's the first prong here of that Strickland analysis. Alone, does it rise to the level of ineffective? No, it doesn't. It just looks very sloppy. He admitted multiple times he was unprepared for trial. Now, I granted we do that when a trial is within 60 days. We ask for continuances. He claimed that he was surprised by the evidence. He was surprised by witness testimony, not only Mr. Perez's wife, but the alleged victim. He claimed that he was surprised by some of the evidence, that he didn't have the correct equipment to review it. He failed to review some of the records of the victim's therapy that came up and argued that he was surprised again. And when I look at this in the totality of the circumstances, I'm thinking, how can counsel be surprised when this is discovery and you have access to witnesses? He certainly had access to what the expert would have said, and he could have flushed that out. The second issue that the court brought up was that there was an unlicensed attorney at the table. This unlicensed attorney participated in bar conferences. He sat at the defense table with the other attorneys. He spoke on the record as an attorney. And the district court actually said that had she known, she would not have allowed him to do that. So it raised a concern with the district court. And the licensing issue happened to be for mental health issues. Now, if the defendant's relying on his counsel to give him a good defense under the Sixth Amendment,
Mr. Cronin, why was that attorney, unlicensed attorney, there? What was the point of that? I wasn't aware of all the details of that.
There were actually three defense attorneys.
Right.
Mr. Phillips was the primary. Mr. Rogers was there, I assume, to help out. Kind of like a paralegal, but he presented himself as an attorney.
I see. Okay.
And it upset at the district court.
You have a little over the district court addressed that specifically as to his participation, indicated that it was a limited participation, that individual never addressed the jury, posed any questions to any witnesses, and that Mr. Perez didn't identify any actual error or omission. And hasn't identified anything a licensed attorney would have done differently. How do you explain that as far as it goes to the prejudice prong?
Alone, it doesn't rise to the level of prejudice. I added that as an instance in that cumulative effect.
But you didn't argue cumulative error down below, did you? Is this the first time cumulative error has been argued?
No, in the petition, I always argue cumulative error. Yes.
And I get your argument on law of the case, but are you contending that had trial counsel been adequately prepared, trial counsel could and should have done a better job of contesting the admission and notice associated with the admission of Dr. P- Coglini's testimony. Are you making that claim here or not?
Exactly. Exactly. I'm arguing trial counsel had no idea what Dr. Coglini was going to say. He was not prepared at all for that.
But what do you do with the fact that a majority of the court said no harm, no foul, that notice was good enough on the direct appeal?
My argument specifically was that on appeal he should have tacked it under the bad faith standard, which he didn't do. And I think the court may have entertained that argument on appeal had he argued the proper standard.
Okay. It's a hard argument to make, but I understand it. Thank you.
My time's up. Thank you.
Mr. Sweeten, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. May it please the court, James Sweeten, from the Clark County District Attorney's Office, representing the respondent. And I want to start off with the law of the case analysis. And I first want to make sure that the record's clear that the bad faith claim that the appellant has made reference to was not opposed by the law of the case down at the district court, nor is it here. That was never the issue, and I think that was what was stated here. But in regards to the law of the case, the state would submit that the law of the case essentially provides that where an issue has already been decided on the merits by the Nevada Supreme Court, the court's ruling is the law of the case, and the issue will not be revisited. The doctrine of the law of the case cannot be avoided by more detailed or precise focused argument subsequently made after reflection on the previous proceedings, and thus the issue previously decided on direct appeal may not be re-argued in the habeas petition. Now, appellate contends that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise certain issues on appeal. And these issues relate specifically to Dr. Paglini's testimony failed to assist the jury, and Dr. Paglini's testimony was prejudicial. Well, both of those issues were previously heard by this court on direct appeal and rejected. In regards to failure...
He's also making, though, an ineffective appellate counsel argument. And it seems to me that your application of law of the case is problematic because, it's a discretionary ruling what you're going to tolerate in the way of an expert disclosure and its admissibility at time of trial. Would you agree with me it's an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes.
So appellate counsel, trial counsel doesn't make any kind of real objection. It goes on through, it comes up on appeal, and appellate counsel, looking at the record where trial counsel didn't do anything, doesn't research it independently, doesn't come up with some of the cases out there like the Court of Appeals decision from New York in Diaz that says this kind of vouching by an expert in this kind of a case is almost per se prejudicial. None of that is vetted. So what does the person who is now doing life in prison do with law of the case when he comes back on a PC and says, hey, my trial counsel and my appellate counsel fell way short of the mark, and the court that decided the first appeal didn't have the advantage of all of this argument and authority it should have had. You're saying law of the case precludes that kind of a Strickland presentation?
Yeah, I respectfully disagree with Justice Pickering in regards to the fact that this was not briefed on appeal. As the court might remember, not only did the...
there was an invitation to amicus counsel... to come in, but that cuts both ways. You could say the briefs by the principal party briefs were inadequate, so amicus was called on to fill the void. I mean, and I was in the dissent, so I want to respect that the decision was made, but it's troubling to me in this PC context.
Well, I think the point that respondent is trying to make is that this court did have the opportunity to fully vet the issues that were presented to it. And I believe that I've argued before you, I'm honored to argue before you, and I've had that opportunity on a few occasions. I think that was the only occasion where I think there was a full argument, hour devoted to argument, I think a little over an hour, actually. We had amicus arguing, we had myself, other parties arguing. So this was very, very extensively vetted, the respondent would submit. And in regards to this...
Let's say it wasn't. Let's go with me hypothetically. Let's say it was raised but obliquely and in passing, and it produced an opinion just like the one here. Would it be law of the case that the defendant could not bring a habeas petition challenging the adequacy of appellate counsel?
The respondent would submit that the very issues that form the basis for the claim on post-conviction have already been vetted by this court and found to be without merit.
And so anytime that happens, you can't go back on PC?
Well, I think that forms the basis of the claim. Because in this particular case, what's happening is that defense counsel or appellant is really just refocusing the arguments, making one change in it, saying essentially was, we've already argued this issue, the merits of it, but I want to just say that my counsel didn't adequately argue it and change the whole argument, come back and re-argue it. That's what's happening here, and that's the very issue behind the law of the case. Once there's an issue that's been resolved in the case, it becomes the law of the case. And if that wasn't the case, we would have a continuous relitigation of issues before not only this court, but all courts. And for that reason, the state would submit that by operation of law in this case, if you look at the two prongs of Strickland, the defense can't make either prong, because this court has already determined that both of these claims are without effect.
So is it the case that unless appellate counsel wholly fails to raise an argument, law of the case will preclude a more thorough, well-grounded presentation of the legal issue in the post-conviction context in every instance?
Well, I think law of the case recognizes that there's already been a decision made in regards to that, and we're not going to rethink it and essentially make the prior decision a decision that can't be relied upon in going forward.
So you would answer my question, yes?
Well, respondent's position essentially would be that, you know, in this particular case, that those issues have been resolved and the law of the case would essentially prevent them from being relitigated here.
Fair enough.
Thank you, Justice Pickering. In regards to the bad faith claim, I mentioned that that this wasn't something that was opposed based upon the law of the case. Appellant contends that counsel on direct appeal was ineffective for failing to argue on direct appeal that the state provided insufficient notice of Dr. Paglini's expert testimony in bad faith. And specifically, what appellant is contending is that the state acted in bad faith because the state did not specify that Dr. Paglini would testify regarding hypothetical situations as they relate to the grooming of child sexual abuse victims. Rather, in such notice, the state provided, as provided by statute, the phrase will testify as to grooming techniques used upon children. The district court found that this argument was without merit. They found that it was futile. And I would submit to the court that in this particular case, the standard of review is plain error because this objection was not made at the trial level, or error so unmistakable that it reveals itself by casual inspection of the record. Now, in this particular case, counsel's essentially saying that he's not making this claim on appeal, that he feels that there was, well, essentially, what counsel's saying here in regards to the bad faith claim the state would submit is without merit, it's futile. He provides nothing to support a finding of bad faith on the part of the state. The district court recognized that the state provided notice as required by NRS 174.234. This included a brief statement, as I indicated, in regards to the subject matter and the substance of testimony, as well as a curriculum vitae, which was provided. Appellant contends that brief statement provided will testify as to the grooming techniques used upon children was insufficient, provided in bad faith. Appellant contends that it didn't detail that the state would elicit from the witnesses hypotheticals as to what specific actions would be consistent with grooming. You know, apparently, appellant is alleging that the state acted in bad faith by trying to hide this from the defendant. However, at appellant's hearing before trial on his motion to exclude Dr. Paglini's testimony, the state made a full record in some detail of what Dr. Paglini would be testifying to. The state detailed that he'd be describing grooming techniques, that he would be applying those techniques to the facts of this case to determine if the facts in this case are consistent with grooming techniques described, and also finally, that the effect of such techniques on children, what they would be, essentially embarrassment, reluctance to disclose the abuse, things of that sort. Now, at the conclusion of the description, Mr. Phillips, defense counsel at trial, did not express surprise. He didn't say, I had no idea that he was going to testify, nothing like that. It was clear that he recognized that that was going to be the testimony. That's the parties recognized that that was going to be the testimony. The focus of Mr. Phillips' argument was having a report from the expert, which one didn't exist, or having publications that the expert might have had, or the qualifications of Dr. Paglini, not the substance of the testimony that was anticipated being elicited. Dr. Paglini ultimately testified just to those things that the state indicated that he would, and there is no evidence that the state acted in bad faith, respondent would submit, that the state was trying to hide anything. That allegation, respondent would submit, is completely belied by the record. There is no plain error here, respondent would admit. Appellate counsel cannot be deemed ineffective for failing to raise a futile issue, and respondent would submit that that's what this is. Now, although that prong alone negates the claim, I will note in regards to the second prong, appellate raised issues in regards to essentially that there might be some difference made because of two things, essentially. One, that in the majority opinion there was a reference made to that there was no claim of bad faith, certainly not recognizing that there was any bad faith, but recognizing that there was no claim made. And the minority opinion, which essentially found, disagreed with the majority opinion in finding that the notice was not adequate. Those were the only basis for the bad faith. Clearly, respondent would submit that there was no showing of bad faith. It's a bare allegation. It's repellent. I also wanted to touch on a few minutes.
Do you agree? Could you state for me, though, why it was correct for the district court to reject the request for an evidentiary hearing on that subject?
Respondent would submit that it was a bald allegation. It's repelled by the record in the manner that I've indicated, which wouldn't merit an evidentiary hearing.
And the petition itself failed to articulate any facts showing bad faith by the state.
And that's also the case in regards to the other claims, Justice Hardesty. In regards to the other claims, and respondent would take issue with defense counsel, and I believe Justice Perry mentioned that the cumulative error was being raised first time here before this court, and that's respondent's understanding as well. That was not previously raised in PCR in front of the district court, and as such, it would be a plain error standard before this court.
Do you concede that he adequately requested an evidentiary hearing? It's just he didn't make a sufficient showing to go on through to one? Is that your position?
I have not seen anything in the record to reflect that. So I cannot say that there isn't something in the record, but I have not seen anything in the record to support that. And I would note that what I have seen in the record is that at the time of hearing, it's essentially a three-page transcript because they come present themselves and we're submitting it on the record, and then
it's
the court makes its ruling. So I can't say that. I haven't seen anything to support it. In the few minutes I have left, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of these errors, and the respondent would agree with some of the comments of justices in regards to there isn't a showing, essentially these are all bald allegations, and there's certainly no showing of prejudice in regards to these allegations. You know, if we go through them, it makes reference to counsel was ineffective for failing to prepare and investigate the case for a couple reasons. One of those reasons would be that counsel was ineffective because counsel objected to the state's introduction of jailhouse calls. Now, there's actually this kind of a two-prong. This is one of the objection is indicated as misconduct as well as failing to stipulate. And I wanted to go into this real quick. This relates to a jail call between appellant and his wife in September 14, 2008, the day after the charge event occurred. It lasts approximately 10 minutes, essentially includes appellant asking his wife to help him get out of this. Appellant's wife discusses that she saw what happened, she talked to the victim, she knows what happened. Appellant tells his wife that he could not control his feelings and he didn't have time for anything to happen. and he continues to tell his wife that he loves her and wanted to help her, and ultimately appellant's wife says that she loves him as well. And then there's discussions in regards to her putting money on his books and his ID number to facilitate those sorts of things. Now, in regards to this, there is nothing, you know, to show why an objection to this coming in would be ineffective assistance. And in fact, counsel made reference to a number of objections, that it was not relevant, it was prejudicial, spouse immunity issues. The issue in regards to not stipulating to the admission of this, the state would note that there was a number of reasons for defense counsel not to stipulate to this. And after not stipulating to it, the counsel vigorously challenged the admission of it and the witnesses at every point, making it very difficult, coming in a very chopped up way. I'd also note the prejudice was low in this particular case because the court redacted that statement of everything having to do anything with the jail, as well as the fact that it happened just the day after the arrest of the defendant in this case, about a year or so prior to trial. Could easily have been, all the jury knew was that it came from the Clark County Detention Center. Could have easily been associated with the fact that he was arrested. Never made reference to him being in custody, never made reference to anything else. There was a number of strategic reasons to essentially not stipulate to that. And the state's, the respondent would submit that in this particular case, trial counsel just did the math. What is the advantages of stipulating and not stipulating? And he made a judgment call. He said on the record, essentially, he thought that it would hurt his client. It's a strategic decision, and the state submits it. It's not challengeable based upon that under the law cited.
Your time's up.
Thank you.
And I'll give you a minute in rebuttal.
Okay. Your Honors, I did request an evidentiary hearing. That's on the first page of the supplement where it says evidentiary hearing requested in the caption. I always do that.
What's the record site for that?
I don't have the actual...
You said that, but is it belied by the record because it was submitted once you came into court?
Excuse me?
I said, is that not belied by the record since it was indicated that you said submitted in open court? Or
No. That we go in for argument for an evidentiary hearing, hoping that she will realize that, hey, there are some disputes of facts and we're going to have an evidentiary hearing. I draft a supplemental petition, very, very detailed, so you can see that stuff in there, because the courts don't like us to waste their time. On bad faith, trial counsel did argue bad faith at sentencing, and with regards to the law of the case, if there's a direct appeal, apparently we can't ever have habeas corpus proceedings, because we argue a different standard. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Sweet and Mr. Carlin, for your arguments in this matter. And this matter will stand submitted. We'll be in recess 11:15.